As you see from my title, I'm going to talk to you about the science of when things happen today. And I'm going to give you a breakdown of what I propose to talk about. Firstly, I'm going to discuss the fundamentals of radiocarbon dating and how it works and how we measure radiocarbon. I'm going to talk about how we calibrate it, and I'm going to give some examples of the work we've done in principle from two different timescales, time periods, the Paleolithic of Western Europe and the ancient Egyptian chronology, which we've recently completed some work on. Now, radiocarbon is formed in the upper atmosphere, at the point of outer space, really, and it's formed by the passage through the universe of cosmic rays, cosmic radiation, which move incredibly quickly. And when they impact, when they hit the top of the Earth's surface, they hit nuclei and particles at the top of the Earth, and they cause a huge range of different explosive reactions, which include the reaction and the creation of a whole range of neutrons, which fizz around and whiz and bang against other atoms and other particles in the upper atmosphere. And sometimes they hit nitrogen-14, and when they do, and they hit it with enough force, a proton is ejected from nitrogen-14, which creates carbon-14 in the upper part of the atmosphere. And this reaction was discovered and outlined and worked out in the 1930s and 40s. And shortly after the creation of carbon-14, it's rapidly oxidized into carbon-14 labeled CO2. And then the CO2 enters the plant and animal life ways on Earth through photosynthesis and through an exchange with the atmosphere and the ocean. And so there is mixing of carbon-14 throughout all of the world, and all living organisms take it up in their food and through the photosynthetic pathway until, unfortunately, animals and plants die, like us. And these Neanderthals are having a great time with this woolly rhino, you can see. And here's here are the bones of the rhino much later. And, of course, when this happens, when death occurs, there is no more replenishment of radiocarbon, only decay. And the key to the radiocarbon method, which was worked out by Willard Libby and published in 1949 in the journal Science, was the half-life of radiocarbon. And Libby's genius was to work that out and give us a dating method. And basically, what we do in our lab is we measure the depletion of carbon-14. So let's say 100% in 1950, after one half-life, 5,568 years has passed, and half of the amount of radiocarbon that we measured at the beginning has now dispersed and gone and decayed back to nitrogen-14. So we're left with 50% of that amount. And after another half-life, two half-lives, 11,100 BP, and so on, three half-lives, four half-lives, we're back to 23,000, five half-lives, 28,000. And then eventually we get back to almost nothing left, a few percent, and finally the limit of the dating technique is reached in our laboratory at about 50 to 55,000 BP. We measure radiocarbon here using an accelerator mass spectrometer. It's a very large particle accelerator that's just over in physics on the other side of Keble Road. This technique was developed in the late 1970s. Our laboratory started in the early 1980s. It was one of the first in the world. And basically what we do is we take the sample that we want to date, we convert it into graphite, we take that graphite, and we put it into this machine, this accelerator here, and we bombard the graphite with cesium ions that creates negatively charged particles. And they come whizzing around this accelerator here, and then they end up at the very far end in the detector out at that end, and we separate all of the isotopes and all of the atomic particles except carbon-14. We select only carbon-14, and we radiocarbon date calculate using the Libby half-life based on the amount of radiocarbon that we measure on this machine. Each sample is in here about 20 minutes, and it's a tremendous technique because it gives us the ability to date very, very much smaller things, because instead of in the old days measuring the decay of carbon-14, we're now directly measuring single particles of carbon-14, so it's much quicker, and we need much smaller amounts. So we need a few milligrams of carbon to do this measurement on the accelerator. It's revolutionized radiocarbon dating. Now, it would be remiss of me not to mention calibration, because in the early days of the development of the radiocarbon technique, there was an assumption that radiocarbon was produced in the upper atmosphere in a completely constant way. It was linear. And in the 1950s and 1960s, much work was undertaken to work out whether or not this assumption was true. And we now know that, of course, it wasn't. And the main reason Well, there are two main reasons for the variation, but the one that concerns us most is variation in the output of the sun and solar radiation. Because the sun acts to ameliorate the cosmic radiation coming through space, and in doing so, it means that less cosmic radiation hits the surface of the atmosphere of the Earth, and therefore less radiocarbon is produced. So as the sun's activity waxes and wanes through millennia, so does the production rate of carbon-14. And this means that in order to interpret our radiocarbon dates in terms of calendar years, we have to convert them somehow. And the way in which we do that is to use dendrochronology. We use tree rings. Here's a classic sequence through a sequence of oak trees, oak tree rings, and you can see the rings that are laying down annually. Oak is a fantastic species for dendrochronology. And also pine as well, and bristlecone pine in particular from North America is a wonderful tree to use for dendrochronology. The tree ring record now in Germany goes back straight from modern times to about 12,690 years ago in a complete sequence. And what we do is we radiocarbon date these tree rings, which are built up on the basis of dendrochronological overlap of trees that are now long dead. So here's a modern tree. And you can see that each tree has a classic sequence of rings in it. And these tree rings have overlapped to trees that are now long dead, and so on and so forth, until we build a dendro record back over, as I say, over 12,000 years now. This work takes decades to do. The Irish tree ring oak chronology took about almost 20 years to put together. It's back to about 7,000 BC. And we radiocarbon date, as I say, these blocks of tree rings because we know independently their age. And then we construct what is called a calibration curve. And here it is. This covers the last 1,400 years from 2000 AD here back to 600 AD here. And you can see the wiggles that correspond to the production rate of carbon-14. So here are our radiocarbon dates here, and here's the calendar date here. So if you want to convert a radiocarbon date into a calendar date, we run a line along here from, let's say, 830 years before present, and then the plus or minus one sigma error. And then we run a line down to the bottom and we read off the calendar date at the bottom there. So the calibrated date for 830 is about 1200 AD. And we do this with computers now. We don't draw lines anymore. So it's just a demonstration. Our laboratory specializes in archaeological dating. We're unique in the world. We're the only lab that does just archaeological dating. And as such, we have a good reputation in the work we do, I think, in that particular field. And we're based in South Parks Road in the Dyson Perrins building, which is opposite the new chemistry building. And this is another picture of our accelerator. And so over the last 25 years or so, we've managed to work on some really interesting material. Some of the highlights for us, I think, would probably include the dating of the Iceman, the Ötzi Iceman from the Austro-Italian Alps. This is a picture as he was found by a couple of Austrian trampers walking past. And you can forgive them, I think, for thinking that this person died recently. But our radiocarbon dating suggested that he died many, many thousands of years ago. In fact, in the Copper Age of Europe, the European Copper Age. So he's about 3,400 BC. And, of course, the most famous object ever dated using radiocarbon is the Shroud of Turin. It comes up again and again and again, and many people are interested in it. Our dates suggested, along with labs to other places, Zurich and Arizona, that this object came from the medieval period, which is consistent with its historical age and historical record. There are moves afoot to redate the shroud because the samples that were taken from the outer part and they thought that might be reworked or refixed. There's a possibility then that the date might be done again. We'll have to see in the future. And every day we get interesting things coming across through the lab to work on and date. On Monday, for example, I was down in London with this, and this is a complete, except for a little hole in the top of it, a complete giant elephant bird egg. And this egg is owned by David Attenborough, so I went down to his house to take a sample. And he'd been given this in 1961 and cracked open. He'd put it back together. He was given it by villagers in pieces, and it was put back together. And then this hole appeared after an accident with a spear that was accidentally dropped on the top of it. But I was able to take a sample from here. It was quite a good hole for me because I was able to easily take a sample. And so we're constantly working on interesting things. It's a really great place to work. And I'd like to now move on to a couple of examples of the kind of work we've been doing. And the first is to do with the European Upper Paleolithic. This is the period when Neanderthal Europe, which had been under Neanderthal settlement for about 250,000 years, was suddenly changed by the arrival of anatomically modern people. In the archaeological record, we find their remains very, very infrequently, but we find an industry that we call the orignation, which is associated with them, and which we assume largely to be the product of anatomically modern people. The transformation took place between about 30 to 45,000 years ago. But one of the problems with dating, as you can see from my diagram at the beginning about the C14 decay, is that when we're back to 30,000 years ago, we're back only at about 3% of the amount of carbon-14 that we have in the modern period. So we're dating something that's infinitesimally small, because after all, only one atom in a trillion atoms of carbon is carbon-14. So take 3% of that level and you're down to very, very low amounts indeed. And this means that contamination can be a major problem when you're trying to date samples from this period. At 50,000 years ago, only 0.1% of the carbon-14 is left compared with the modern period. And so dating material from the Neanderthals and from anatomically modern people in the first part of the transition to the Upper Paleolithic is very, very difficult indeed. What we do, therefore, is to take huge care in pre-treating and carefully cleaning our samples. And since the year 2000, just after I originally came over to Oxford, we have used a technique called ultrafiltration. Basically, what we do is we take the bone, in this case it's a lovely bone point, which was used as a spear by a modern person, and we take a drill sample out of the bottom of this. It's about that high, and we take about half a teaspoon of powder, and we want to isolate the collagen from the bone, the protein part of the bone. Only 20% of modern bone consists of this collagen protein, and so we have to clean it up. We use an acid to remove most of the bone and isolate just the raw collagen. And then we take the collagen-soluble collagen, and we put it into a slightly acidic water at 65 degrees, and we gelatinize it. And that basically takes the single molecule of collagen, which is a triple helix composed of 3,000 amino acid in length polypeptide chains, and it untwists it, it brings it into solution, and it separates it from contaminants that may have built up during the history of the bone. And then we use this ultrafilter, which is a small plastic molecular sieve about that big, and we put the soluble collagen in it. We whiz it around in a centrifuge, and anything that's smaller than the molecular weight that we want to trap above it is separated. So in this case, we want to separate anything that's lower than 30,000 kilodaltons. A dalton is a measure of molecular mass. We want to separate anything that's smaller than that from anything that's bigger, like this long chain of 1,000 amino acids, which weighs a lot more than the cutoff of the filter. So we do this, and we trap above it in the filter material like this, which is original to the bone. It's a really nice technique. And then after that, we combust the gelatin, we burn it in a mass spectrometer, and then we measure it on our accelerator. The whole process takes about a week, but because we have so many samples in our laboratory, it's about 4 months before we get a result back to the submitter. So that's the basic pre-treatment. And what we've found over the last few years is that there's been a big impact on our ability to date reliably material from this period. So that lovely bone point I showed you before, that was originally dated in the late 1980s. And it produced a date of 28,080 years before present. That always was considered to be slightly later than what you would expect for similar types of artifact that had been dated elsewhere in Western Europe. And so my colleague Roger Jacoby, who was from the British Museum, sadly passed away in December last year. Roger and I decided to redate these types of objects from the British Isles to see whether we could improve the reliability of the dating using ultrafiltration. And what we found was that when we redated the same bone point using an ultrafilter, we got a date of 31,700, demonstrably older than the previous date, and we would suggest a lot more reliable because of the difficulty in dating this type of material because of small contaminants that can really affect the measurements that we make. And since then, we've redated many other items and many other objects from around the British Isles. An object such as this is really, really important to date properly because in the whole of the British Isles, there are only seven archaeological sites that date to this period. And this is really the only bone object from that period in the entire country that we know of. And it was discovered in a museum by Roger, looking through the remains of archaeological materials from this side uphill in Somerset. This is the model that we think explains the distribution of the first modern people. We think they came from the Levant area, but this is now under dispute. They probably came up the Danube River. There's an early series of sites up the Danube gorges, and we think that the first modern people probably favored freshwater sources. They probably followed them. And an alternate route is along the Mediterranean coast. Don't forget the climate was very different, and so this was all submerged. This was not underwater. It was all dry land. So people may have come along a southerly route. And I draw your attention to these dates here. These are 36 in thousands of years BP. So again, we're talking about radiocarbon dates of 37, 38,000 years ago for the transformation of Neanderthal Europe into modern human Europe. But these dates are the thing that concern us, because if we're getting problems with the radiocarbon dates, as I showed you before, then how much really can we trust these dates? And we've been working over the last 3 or 4 years on a big research project to try and work out whether the dates that we've got are reliable or not, and I'm afraid to say that many of them aren't. It's a case of starting from scratch. But one thing that we intriguingly are able to do now with a lot more certainty is to understand more about the climatic conditions of the first people and the Neanderthals as they neared extinction. And that we do this by the great scientific breakthrough of the Greenland ice core records. And here's a picture of Greenland showing you the location of the deep ice cores that have been produced over the last few decades. The most recent one is the North Grip record here. And this is the oxygen isotope record that you may have seen previously from the ice core, the deep ice core here. Here's the Holocene up here. Here's where we are. And down here is the Eemian 125,000 years ago. And where you see pulses up in the oxygen isotope, that's increasing temperature, and pulses down are decreasing temperature. This ice core took about 3.5 years to drill. It's 3 kilometers deep, and it reached the bedrock in Greenland, upon which they found DNA from tropical forests. Here, at the top, is the warming at the end of the last glacial. The end of the last glacial here is where warming starts. And a recent paper in Science showed that this warming consists of a 10-degree increase in temperature that took place in less than 3 years. So we're talking about temperature pulses and temperature changes that take place remarkably quickly. And that must have a significant impact on our ability to understand the process of the extinction of Neanderthals and the arrival of modern people in this part of the world. We can compare these records later in my talk. One of the most important human remains that we have in the British Isles is a human maxilla. There it is here, from the site at Kent's Cavern, which is near Torquay. It was discovered in 1926 in excavations in that famous site. And it was identified as a modern human by Sir Arthur Keith, who famously says the teeth differ from those of a modern Englishman only in their degree of wear and freedom from disease. He identified it as a modern person, and we've accepted his diagnosis ever since. It was directly radiocarbon dated here in the early 1980s to 30,900 years before present. It's one of the few direct dates of a modern person that we have in the world, in this part of the world. But is it reliable? Well, based on our work in the ultrafiltration, we started to get a bit suspicious about the reliability of that date, because there is visible glue on the surface of the bone, and we think that that may have become incorporated into the original measurement. It's too small to radiocarbon date again without destroying a significant amount of it. So instead of doing that, what we decided to do was to date material above and below the fine spot of this modern human fossil in Kent's Cavern in the site. But because it was excavated so long ago, it's very difficult to go back to the site and excavate it again. We have to rely on material from museums which has been curated in them. And again, my colleague Roger spent a huge amount of time in finding bones and linking them with the excavation diaries from the 1920s so that we could select material to date that was of unimpeachable context, because we want to know indisputably that material is above or below this fine spot if we're to bracket its proper age. Here are the results we got. Now, the results are in depth below the surface of the cave floor, 8'3" down to 19'20". So that's a very deep sequence. And you can see that we have a lot of radiocarbon dates there down in this column. And here are the species of bone that were dated. Where you see a red date, that's an ultrafiltered date. And when you see a white date, that's an old date that's non-ultrafiltered. And you can see that we redated, for example, this woolly rhinoceros bone. We redated it using ultrafiltration. We got a date that was about 1,500 years older. We dated another sample which was joined to it in the archaeological site, and we got a date that was the same, but again, older than the previous measurement that we'd made in the 1980s. Most disturbing was the date for this woolly rhinoceros cranial fragment, which was dated at 30,220 years ago. The redate on the same bone using ultrafiltration produced a date of 37,000 years ago. Now that is really critical because this is above, just above, the date of the human right maxilla, which means I think that the date of 30,000 is almost certainly not right. It's older than that. It must be, if it's in the right context in the site. It must be, we think, between about 35 and 37,000 if you look at these radiocarbon dates above and below. Below that, we got some older dates that sometimes seem to be a bit out of sequence. You can see that 40,000 is below 45. And we think there's an explanation for this because in the lower parts of the site, there was a lot of mixing of material. And these samples come from two different trenches that are about 3 meters apart. And so we think that in this particular location, there may be some lateral movement and post-depositional movement from ice wedging and ice coring, for example. But the most important date that we've been obtaining, we consider is whether or not this date is right. And as you can see, we think now that it's not. When we look at this date in its calibrated context, and we compare it with other dates from Neanderthals and modern humans, it's very interesting. Because here you can see these dates here are from a site in northern France, which is from the Aurignacian. So these radiocarbon dates at about 40,000 years ago are radiocarbon dates of modern people and the sites of the Aurignacian. And this is the date of the site of Kent's Cavern, the Kent's Cavern maxilla. And you can see it's much earlier than the modern human dates that we now accept as being reliable. And it's also at about the same date or similar date to samples from Neanderthal sites in Belgium and in the British Isles, such as in Glaston and Lincolnshire. So here we have an interesting distribution of radiocarbon dates, which suggests that this date from Kent's Cavern may in fact be perhaps either a very, very early modern person, or possibly could it be a Neanderthal? Well, this is a very big problem because it's so fragmentary. You can see the size of it. It's very difficult to hand on heart for any specialist and paleoanthropologist to say this is a Neanderthal, apparently, or this is a modern human. And this is my friend Beth Shapiro, and she's an expert in ancient DNA. And we carefully drilled some bone out of this tooth, and she took it to her lab, and she tried to extract base pairs from a Neanderthal, and she tried to fish out Neanderthal sequences from the bone that we analyzed. Unfortunately, there wasn't enough for us to get a definitive answer. So at the moment, we're still waiting. But in a few months, we hope to publish a paper which will put to bed the story about this. And interestingly enough, what we think is that it may actually be a modern human. And if it is, it's going to change our interpretation of when people started to arrive in Western Europe, because this is the very, very farthest end of the spectrum in terms of movement of people. And so if it is a modern human, it really is crucially important. But the radiocarbon age is the thing that started us thinking about whether it really was. Everybody else had accepted that it was probably just a modern human. Another very famous specimen that we've been working on is the Red Lady of Paviland. Here are the bones of the Red Lady. They currently lie about 100 meters that way. They're in the Museum of Natural History. You can see a reconstruction of the burial of the Red Lady. The bones themselves are kept backstage, as it were. The Red Lady was excavated from a site on the Gower Peninsula in Wales. Here's the Gower Peninsula, Swansea about there. Here's the site. And it's a fantastic coastal site where you've got this amazing series of cliffs and caves on the coast. Here's the sea level at high tide here. So these are rocky, underwater for some of the time. And the Red Lady was found in this fissure, about 20 metres high and about 30 metres in depth. This is the man who excavated the bones of the Red Lady. This is William Buckland, Professor Buckland, Dean Buckland. He was the first professor of geology at the University Museum here. He was the canon of Christchurch, the Dean of Westminster, a very, very bright man. And he found the first dinosaur remains near Stonesfield in Oxfordshire. He was not only bright, but slightly eccentric. He used to excavate in an academic gown. He used to give lectures on horse. One of his stated aims was to eat his way through the animal kingdom. he used to eat all sorts of things. He said that the worst things he ever ate were a mole and a blue bottle flies. He said those were absolutely disgusting. And John, I won't go on, I could go on for a lot about this, but so he's such a great person. He said, Ruskin said that he went to dinner once at Buckland's house and he was served dormice on toast. Anyway, this is the inside of the cave where the Red Lady was found. The Red Lady lay about here. And we know that because of Buckland's amazing excavation work. He went to the site in 1823 after he was alerted to the discovery of elephant bones there. Now, don't forget, in 1823, of course, Buckland, being a religious man, was very, very focused on the flood and the biblical evidence. And he excavated this, I think, brilliantly. And you can see a cutaway view of the site, people climbing up the side of the cave here and people up a ladder here. And then here, the bones of the Red Lady lay. You can see there's the skeleton, head, skeleton. And here, at the head of the skeleton, a complete mammoth skull. It was brilliantly excavated, but Buckland had a problem. The bones of extinct animals were found in association, and it really didn't tally with his ideas about the creation. And so instead of thinking slightly laterally, of course, bearing in mind the time he was working, he instead decided that the bones were of an exciseman who had been overcome by smugglers and killed and deposited in the cave. And then later he changed that interpretation in the book from which this illustration comes. In his very famous book in 1823, he changed his interpretation and he decided that the body was worthy of the story of a red woman or a red lady, who perhaps was associated with the Roman camp nearby and perhaps was a prostitute, and who was killed, perhaps, or died in the cave. And the reason that the bones are called the Red Lady, the red, is because it was covered in red ochre. And so this is where the name the Red Lady comes from. So Buckland interpreted the bones incorrectly. It was much, much later, though, that we discovered that the bones were actually of Paleolithic age. And that was by 1875. And the story of the Red Lady goes, and there's another slightly different twist, because, of course, it was also later discovered that the bones weren't those of a woman at all. They were actually the bones of a man. So I feel really sorry for the Red Lady, because it's come down to history with us as with the name the Red Lady, when in fact he's actually not. He was a healthy adult male of about 25 when he was buried here. Alongside him later, were excavated by one of Buckland's successors, William Solis, from the museum here, were excavated other objects that we now think were probably associated with the burial. These included bits of ivory, carved, worked ivory, this amazing pendant, which comes from the cancerous tumor of a mammoth tusk, which was perforated afterwards through a natural-shaped hole there. So this was worn probably around the neck. And these curious things, we don't know really what they are. They think they might be knives. They're called the Paviland knives. And they're made of the rear bone of a horse, metapodial, carved into a slightly pointed shape. Some of the others have got, there are three of them, they've got pointed shapes at the end. These have all been radiocarbon dated. I'll talk about them in a second. This is a reconstruction by Professor Stephen Aldhouse Green of what the excavation, what the original scene probably looked like. You can see out of the front of the cave, there's grassland because the sea level was, of course, much, much lower than it is today. And these ivory, carved ivory rings, it wasn't the time of the Harry Potter, but it's... but the interpretation was that they might be wands, mystical wands. And here's the Red Lady, the Red Man, I should say, lying down here with the red ochre being sprinkled over him by these various people. So it's a nice reconstruction of the possible scene. The Red Lady was originally dated in the 1960s with radiocarbon by the British Museum Laboratory, and they produced a date of 18,460, proving indisputably that it was indeed a Paleolithic specimen. But the date was always considered to be a little bit problematic because of the fact that at 18,000 years ago, the climate was very, very bad. Here we are today in the year 2000, and at the time of the last glacial maximum, 18,000 years ago, here's what the climate tells us. The climate record from Greenland tells us, and the geological record tells us was the case here. We had a massive ice sheet over the British Isles, and Paviland and the Gower Peninsula is just there. It's only 6 kilometres from the front of that ice sheet. So it seems 18,000 years ago, probably not a very attractive place to be living. And for that reason, people have been, were slightly skeptical about the radiocarbon date. But because the date was so new and because the technique was so new, many people accepted it and thought that perhaps people were just a lot cleverer back then, and perhaps the hunters were able to source material from a wider area and they were just happened to be living there perhaps on a seasonal basis. But later on, in the 1980s, a new date was obtained, which confirmed that this date was too young. This date was obtained in 1988, and then later, further work by Stephen Aldhouse Green obtained another date, which, lo and behold, was about the same. And this really proved that the specimen was indeed from what we would call the late Gravettian period of the prehistoric record, and that the specimen truly was within a cold part of the record. Because here, when you can see these radiocarbon dates that I've just shown you on that table, here are those new dates, and they sit within the cold part of the oxygen isotope record. These are the warmer interstadial periods, and these are the colder stadials. So when we compare at these dates, we can see that the Red Lady was probably there in a cold part of the year, of the last glacial. But of course, Roger and I again had some doubts about these dates because of the fact that they weren't very rigorously treated and prepared. Neither were any of the other dates that were obtained. And the other dates are really intriguing because they showed a sequence, a sort of a history of the site, which spans quite a considerable period of time. We go up to, for example, the latest date from one of those bone knives that was obtained in the 1980s was about 22,000 years ago. And some of the older ones were about 29,000 years ago. These are charred bones. The bones of the Red Lady I've just shown you are here. An ivory pendant, that lovely ivory pendant I showed you, was dated a little bit later. And the archaeologist who was involved in obtaining these dates interpreted them as meaning that there were revisitations to the site over millennia. And he coined this term locus consecratus, that people moved back to the site again and again to revisit it because it was somehow sacred in their memory. We tried to duplicate these dates. We tried to redate them, but every single time we couldn't get good enough quality collagen from them. And so Roger and I think that these dates are simply aberrant. They're wrong. They're inaccurate, and they should be just not treated as reliable. And so our interpretation is completely different. And it's completely different because, thankfully, Jim Kennedy, the director of the Oxford Museum, gave us permission to redate the Red Lady. The bones now are pretty pitiful. They've been worked on by many, many people. And in the 1960s, Kenneth Oakley, for example, had to take a large amount of a femur for a radiocarbon date because they needed so much more material back then. But nowadays, we don't. We need small amounts. So I was able to drill a hole just in here and take a very small amount of bone such that you can't actually see exterior damage to this part of the clavicle. And the radiocarbon date we obtained when we ultrafiltered it was 29,000 years BP, much, much older. We also dated a rib fragment, which had been dated before with one of the dates I showed you, and we got a date that was just under 29,000 years ago, again, much, much older. And we think now that the real age of the Red Lady falls within interstadial 6. And when we compare this with other dates that we've obtained from other parts of Europe, it all starts to now make sense. What we think is that the British Isles were really only settled in periods where the weather was sufficiently good enough for people to be living here. At all other times, the peninsula, the British Isles formed a kind of a peninsula from mainland Europe, which was pretty inhospitable and quite cold, and particularly cold during the stadials. So we think that probably this makes a lot more sense than the previous dates did. And we're now able to compare the dates of the Red Lady with other examples from across Europe. And it tells us that this is right at the very beginning of the Gravettian period. So we have the first modern humans, the Aurignacians, come in, and then the Gravettian period starts. And this involves a completely new range of behavior. They're modern people, but they have a new range of way of doing things. They have much more improved clothing, much improved housing. They make huts out of mammoth bones, for example, in Russia. And they're able to cope with a different range of temperatures. They also hunt much more effectively. They have new tools. And this bone from the Red Lady, the bones from the Red Lady, are very important because they are the earliest representatives of the Gravettian industry, the Gravettian people that we have now in Europe. I'd now like to move on completely to a different area entirely, and this is the chronology of ancient Egypt. So we're going from very old to very young. Of course, Egypt is different because it's the historical record bar none. This is a picture from Abydos, which shows the temple wall at Seti I, and you can see these fantastic cartouches here. Each one of about 76 records the name of a pharaoh. Some of the cartouches are missing, however. And so whilst looking on the face of it, we have a beautiful record of rulers from the New Kingdom all the way back to the beginning of the Old Kingdom, the first dynasty of Europe. We have different parts of the record which are rather better known than others. And of course, in the New Kingdom, the more recent part, we have a lot more information and a lot more reliable information about when pharaohs started to rule and when they didn't. And back in the early parts of the Old Kingdom, there's a lot more slack in the system. There are missing rulers. There are rulers that seem to have ruled for 100 years, 120 years, which I doubt very much is really true. And so we have some areas of uncertainty in the early part of the record of ancient Egypt. And what our project was concerned about, what we were interested in, was to check whether or not radiocarbon really worked in Egypt, or whether there was a problem. And we obtained some funding to do this from the Leverhulme Trust, and we embarked on a research project. When we look at the New Kingdom, we can divide it up into dynasties, the 18th dynasty, the 19th, and the 20th, from about 1550 BC. And within the New Kingdom, we have an extremely good record of different rulers. So, for example, we have here Thutmose III, who is here pictured smiting his enemies. He was the great conqueror of Egypt. Later on, we have Akhenaten, Nefertiti, and, of course, the very famous Tutankhamun. And later on in the 19th dynasty, this big chunk here is taken up with Ramses II, who was a ruler who ruled for 66 years and 2 months. That's how precise Egyptian chronology can get. And you might think to yourself, well, why bother radiocarbon dating it? Well, as I say, we wanted to check whether or not the dates were right or wrong, whether there was a really important problem that could tell us something about the application of radiocarbon around the world. The Nile River, of course, is the lifeblood of the civilization of ancient Egypt and continues to this day. This is a satellite image from NASA. And what we were really interested in exploring was whether or not the problems that people like Zahi Hawass had associated with radiocarbon dating in this part of the world were to do with some problem with the river, bringing, for example, old carbon down from the source all the way down the river, and that plants growing near the river, such as papyrus, perhaps would be taking up old carbon from the source, growing within it, and producing radiocarbon dates, which were somehow wrong. And so we wanted to try and investigate this scientifically. The problem was that, of course, the Aswan High Dam was built by NASA, and this has changed the hydrology of the river. So we wanted to get material, really, that we knew exactly the age, that we could then radiocarbon date, rather like the tree rings at the beginning of the talk I showed you. Well, Oxford's a fantastic place, and the theme of this meeting is about shared treasures, and we were able to, through my friend Andrew Shortland, having a very fortuitous meeting with another researcher in the university who works at the Oxford Herbaria, we were able to discover that in the Herbaria down in the plant sciences department, they have a collection of material of antiquarian collectors who were in Egypt in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, who collected samples like this, plants from Egypt, that were collected on a precisely known date. So we knew the year and sometimes the day that they were collected. And so we were able to get permission to radiocarbon date some of these plant fragments to enable us to check whether or not they were giving us the right age or not. And here are the results we obtained. This is the calibration curve that I showed you at the beginning. And this is 1925, and this is 1700 AD. And these diamonds, these yellow diamonds, are the results of the radiocarbon dates we obtained. And you can see that pretty much they sort of fit around the curve, the calibration curve here. The calibration curve is, as I said before, made up of wood from the Northern Hemisphere, from England, Germany, and North America. And these dates, of course, are from the plant fragments from Egypt. So you can see that some of them, however, are just a bit high on the line. They're a bit above. And when we looked at the average and we did some statistics, we found out that some of them were actually meaned consistently above this level, and that overall there was an average 20 years plus or minus 5 offset from the expected age that they should be. And this is interesting because we think what this is caused by is by a slightly different growing season in Egypt compared to the Northern Hemisphere. They're plants there are actually sampling a slightly different level of carbon-14 from the atmosphere than the trees in the northern part of the northern hemisphere. And this is the reason for this offset. That was interesting and very important. And then we had money to do about 300 radiocarbon dates from ancient Egyptian sites. And so we went around and we selected them from museums, including the Ashmolean Museum, the Pitt Rivers Museum here in Oxford, as well as here. This is some samples of grain from King Djoser from the pyramid, the Step Pyramid, which were found underneath the pyramid. And these come from Kew Gardens. And also, for example, here, this is a mud brick. You see this mud brick? This is a brick that contains pieces of plant material that were incorporated when the brick was made. And then somebody came along and stamped the cartouche of Thutmosis III on the top of the brick when it was wet. So we can assume that the date comes fairly close to the rule of Thutmosis III. And we can use that radiocarbon date to compare with the date given to us by the historical record of Egypt. Now, when we get a series of radiocarbon dates from a series of pharaohs like this, we get a probability distribution for the age based on lots and lots of radiocarbon dates. So from each of these rulers, we get a series of radiocarbon dates that give us this probability distribution. And using a technique called Bayesian calibration, Bayesian statistical analysis, we're able to use the information provided to us by the chronological record of Egypt, the sequence of rulers. We're able to use that in a mathematical modeling approach to produce boundaries between the rulers as they change through the history of ancient Egypt. And so you can see here that these are the dates for Amenhotep II and Amenhotep III and Amenhotep IV, and that between these two there are periods of overlap between them, which represent the boundaries between the end of one person's rule and the beginning of another person's rule. And so using the Bayesian approach, we were able to generate, from our radiocarbon dates, a whole series of probability distributions like this for the beginning and end of one Egyptian pharaoh's rulership to another. And using this technique, we were then able to produce a whole sequence of precise radiocarbon measurements, A, and also boundaries, transition zones between the two rulers. And we were able to produce here, and for example, in the New Kingdom that I was talking about, from the start of the 18th dynasty all the way through to the end of the rule of Ramses VI, we were able to produce these probability distributions for the periods when one ruler ended and another ruler began. And when we compared that with the historical chronology, the historical record based upon temple archives, papyrus, and all of the inscriptions and archives that people had worked on for the last, well, since the 3rd century BC, if you look at Manetho, the Greek scholar, then this is what the comparison looked like. And what you can see is that our radiocarbon probability distributions match pretty closely the dates given to us through the work of Egyptologists over the last 150 years or so. But it gets even a little bit sexier than that, because if you remember prior to the very beginning of this part of the talk, I said that we had a reservoir effect. We had this 20-year offset between what we thought the age should be and what the actual radiocarbon date should be. Well, we also experimented with using that in our modeling work. And when we include a 20-year offset in this particular model, the dates actually fall bang on where they should be. So we conclude in our paper that was published earlier this year, we conclude that the historical record of Egypt is absolutely fantastic. And we've demonstrated and we've proved that using radiocarbon. But also, this has given us the ability now to go back further to the Old Kingdom, to the beginnings of the Old Kingdom and the first dynasty of Egypt. And it's given us greater confidence to be able to radiocarbon date those periods where the historical record is not nearly so precise, and where there are major areas of uncertainty and disagreements between scholars based on the historical evidence that they have to hand. So I think we've made a reasonable contribution, and I don't agree with Zahi Hawass at all, suffice it to say. Very finally, this weekend is themed on meeting minds, shared treasures, and it's, I think, interesting when we consider how the material that we work with comes to us through time, from the early stages of the archaeological record, where the material is used by people, and when it becomes incorporated into the sites. And then all the way through this chain of events that leads us finally to the laboratory, where we make our measurements and where we do our work. And at each stage of this process, there are things that can affect the reliability of the results and what we get and what we do. In the site, for example, people come along and rebuild things. They use old bricks and they use them on new temples. They dig holes. They make a real mess of things. And the archaeological record is always incomplete. Similarly, when the excavators come along, some of them aren't particularly good. They don't record things very clearly. William Buckland was an exception for his time. Most people simply didn't have time to record things. They didn't bother. They were just treasure hunters and treasure seekers. In the museums as well, people come along and they think, oh, I should perhaps conserve this and I'll cover it with some glue or I'll make it look better, paint it. And so we get also problems with museum curations and collections, and all of which serves to impact and affect the reliability of the work we do. But I think in looking at this chain of events, it's also really, really interesting and really important to remember that we find out so much more about the material and the objects that come down to us through time, not just for the benefit of the scientific work that we do, but also also in terms of telling us of the history of that object, the history of those objects, and where they come from. And that, in many cases, is just as interesting and just as important as the final measurements that we do. It all works together. It's all integrated. So it's this lovely relationship between people and objects that is so interesting and so important. And I think one of the things that I love about the work that we do is being able to collaborate and work with people in museums, because the museums in Oxford and in the British Isles and, of course, in other countries around the world are just amazing repositories of material that to this day continue to offer up their secrets and to tell us and inform us more about the archaeological past. I'd like to acknowledge all of my colleagues at the Radiocarbon Accelerator Unit. It's a real team effort, and I'd particularly like to acknowledge the director of our lab, Christopher Bronk-Ramsey, and also Mike D, who was the PhD student who worked so hard on the Egyptian chronology record that we published earlier this year. Thank you very much for your time.